The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
There's a reason that we live so far from Hollywood. In the country, looking hard to find a home. But nothing perfect or considered.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt on Friday, June the 12th in the year of the plague 2020 inside the Beltway. It is Friday. I know you are happy about that. We could all use a good summer weekend. From the carnival going on in the streets of Seattle, I believe the mayor called the anarchists a block party, to the sweltering heat of the Beltway, wherever you are in between, take the week off, rest, enjoy. Try and stay socially distant. Pray for people who are in the ICUs. Pray for the country's healing and relax. What I did yesterday was to put aside from my mind the current news cycle and the controversy, as they say in Great Britain, about race and focus on what I think the election will be about in November. I think we have a very clear view now. And I wrote that column for the Washington Post. They chose the headline, Biden is invisible, Trump is running against himself. And it's already, it went up late last night, and it's already got 2,300 comments. I never read the comments, I just look at the number. And I want to begin this Friday show, which will include a long interview with one of the world's great theologians, N.T. Wright, and the Hillsdale Dialogue with Dr. Larry Arnn and Dr. Thomas West about Plato. Plus the news as it occurs, market updates, things like that. All the news you need, the analysis you must have. But I want to begin this Friday so you can remember all weekend the choice that we have before us. And please send this column, which is on the front page over at WashingtonPost.com. They list the columns on the top right-hand corner. All you do is scroll down two or three and you'll find mine, Hugh Hewitt. Biden is invisible. Trump is running against himself. I'll double-check that just to make sure that I'm not giving you erroneous direction. It stays up there for a few hours. Yep, it is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 thing you'll see on the right-hand column. Biden is invisible. Trump is running against himself. And it reads thus. The country faces an election of choices as clear as any we have had in modern times, with clear consequences as well. Vote for President Trump, and you are voting for the Constitution, military strength, and robust economic growth. Vote for former Vice President Joe Biden, and you are voting for bureaucrats, appeasement abroad, and economic entropy. These are the policy choices embedded in each candidate. There is also a temperamental choice to be made. Trump is chaos theory contained in a man, an explosive combination of complete candor as to what he thinks and feels, and a willingness to brawl, an almost animal energy for the fray. Biden is clearly not that. He is mostly invisible these days, but he hasn't just lost a step, he's lost a lap. His White House would be marked by echo chamber enthusiasts, and the control of the appointees he brings along with him a haphazard and a dangerous step for the Republic. With Trump, all will be well in the country, and there will be upheaval inside the Beltway, Manhattan, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood. With Biden, the deep blue centers of genuine privilege will have their restoration. The White House Correspondents Association dinner will regain its luster. Trump is running against himself. Some days he does well, others he doesn't. And he allows the unfairness of the Beltway game to distract him. The last 3 years have been marked by the Beltway elite's desperate attempts to destroy the president with unprecedented plots and tactics. Even this week, we see the continued assault on the due process rights of retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the president's first national security advisor, who pleaded guilty in 2017 to a single count of lying to the FBI, a plea the general now wants to withdraw in light of exculpatory evidence wrongly withheld from him before that plea, and which the Justice Department now also wants to toss. The elites fight on, trying to ruin Flynn as they continue their assault on the legitimacy of the executive branch. The Never Trump Rump Group, meanwhile, amps up their screeds daily, inventing a new way every day to raise each other in the poker game of invective, the likes of which we've never seen. It reminds me of Robin Williams's Peter Pan in the movie Hook, playing the insult game at dinner with the Lost Boys, with just as much effect as that movie had as on the real world. Nothing has worked to slow Trump down, so now it must be racial politics. The scourge of the nation, put not to the service of justice for the poor, who Trump had served quite well with jobs, good jobs, until the Chinese Communist Party lied about a deadly virus unleashed on the world and upended the blue-collar boom. That boom is returning. It would once again lift all communities. Trump's team is serious and finely fitted for his temper, which is, of course, volatile. Developers are rarely shy in retiring. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is a man speaking for Trump in the United States abroad. The Chinese Communist Party and the mullahs of Iran hate Pompeo, and they wish him gone. Robert C. O'Brien is the steady national security advisor, making sure, finally, that Trump's vision, and not that of traditional D.C. conservative foreign policy elite, is implemented. New Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, himself a real estate developer, is the match that was needed. The West Wing is working. Its power fixer was once Rudy Giuliani. It is now Jared Kushner, who delivered prison reform, a peace plan for the Middle East that may actually work, and a supply bridge to the regions most pressed by the virus. With Biden, you will get, well, who exactly? My bet, AOC and the squad, as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her pack of hard-left acolytes are known, but also the restoration of the foreign policy appeasers who see in a nuclear Iran, as they did in 1994 with a nuclear North Korea, inevitability. There will be silky voices and vague assurances about the proper path of history. And then China and Iran will trample all before them. The most malignant authoritarians will again have what they want, predictability, and predictable surrender of U.S. interests as their backstop. The Obama years of decline will return in force. Ignore the howling from the usual suspects. This presidential race presents the clearest of choices. Another American century, one in which recovery from the virus is rapid and enduring, or decline. The Constitution and its liberties, guaranteed but separated powers in the three branches and among the states, or a vast bureaucratic web of rules and rulers. You choose. That's my post column. I think it's very, very blunt and to the point. And it has enraged the left-wing nutters who inhabit the column commentators at the Washington Post. But I don't care. It's the truth. Please cut and paste it and send it everywhere. If you're a subscriber and you can't get behind the paywall, I'm sorry. You might want to take the free subscription offer up just so you can get it. Donald Trump himself was in Dallas last night. I want to play for you what he said about racism. First, he said, we've got to make the police better. Cut number one.
In recent days, there's been vigorous discussion about how to ensure fairness, equality, and justice for all of our people. Unfortunately, there are some trying to stoke division and to push an extreme agenda, which we won't go for, that will produce only more poverty, more crime, more suffering. This includes radical efforts to defund, dismantle, and disband the police. They want to get rid of the police forces. They actually want to get rid of it. And that's what they'd do, and that's where they'd go. And you know that because at the top position, There's not going to be much leadership. There's not much leadership left. Instead, we have to go the opposite way. We must invest more energy and resources in police training and recruiting and community engagement. We have to respect our police. We have to take care of our police. They're protecting us. And if they're allowed to do their job, they'll do a great job. And you always have a bad apple no matter where you go. You have bad apples. And there are not too many of them. And I can tell you, there are not too many of them in the police department. We all know a lot of members of the police. I was listening today, and a friend of mine was on, very important person, said some of the best people he's ever met are policemen, law enforcement people. And they're taking care of people that in many cases they never even met before.
Contrast that, would you? Just quickly, play cut 15, Joe Biden at a Philadelphia presser yesterday.
He's going down to Texas on Juneteenth, right? The first major massacre, literally speaking, of the Black Wall Street, right? Years ago.
That's actually not right. Cut number 17, Joe Biden short-circuiting in the same press conference.
You know, the rapidly rising
that's Joe Biden. Says, cut number 18. One more bit of Joe Biden.
I'm beginning to get bored by my own talk here. But
that's the choice, America, and that's the rundown. Welcome back, America. I am Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for listening. Let's look at what markets did yesterday. This business story of the day brought to you by Birch Gold. And a lot of you are taking my advice and going to HughGold.com and diversifying a portion of your retirement portfolio. Don't do it all, 10 or 20%. The people that will get it done quickly and professionally, make sure you have secure physical gold and silver as a portion of your retirement. That is there as the anchor against disaster and as a guard against inflation, which I believe is inevitable given the amount of money, the sheer volume of money. We've never seen anything like this. The Fed's balance sheet, I think, has gone from $7 to $12 trillion in 3 months. We would never have imagined that possible without runaway inflation. And I don't think it's possible without runaway inflation. And gold is a hedge against that. Birch Gold is the place also to buy physical gold for your own possession. Text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They'll be back to you. No obligation. Perfectly free. They'll send you the information you need. Or you can go to HughGold.com and contact them that way. Yesterday, if you're blind, deaf, and dumb, and you weren't watching the news or having anyone tell you what was going on, enormous sell-off as two things happened. Fear of the virus returned. Because of bits of news here and there, you know, increased admissions in Arizona, though the ICU capacity remains at pretty much the same percent. Arizona is an older state like Florida. And recognition that those massive protests are, in fact, going to make people sick. And we're going to have a second wave this summer, and it's already beginning to hit. And we have better therapeutics, the good news is. And hopefully people who were fragile stayed away from those demonstrations. Young people get the coronavirus and they can get knocked back pretty hard. A few of them will die, but it is primarily a disease of the elderly and the infirm, those with underlying conditions. And so the market took profits and it worried yesterday. And it went down 1,861 points. The NASDAQ went down 527. My favorite stock, my only stock, Amazon, went down $90 yesterday after rising, yeah, I 250 during the week. Some crazy amount it had gone up, and people took profits. I don't sell. I don't trade. I'm not a trader. I always figure that there are a lot of people who are a lot smarter than I am doing day trading, so I'm not going to try. It's like running against Olympians, not my game. So the Amazon was down $89 yesterday. I expect it will fully make up those losses today because the transfer of equity from old retail to new retail continues. But the good news of the morning and the reason that markets abroad are so strong, and I mean markets abroad are very strong this morning. In Germany, it's up 1.4%. In England, it's up 1.3%. Crude is up to $36. Gold is at $1,741. The 10-year Treasury remains the lowest interest rates for buying a home ever. Talked to my friend Andrew Del Rey yesterday about this, by the way. You can go to andrewandtodd.com. And he just finished refinancing, doing a reverse mortgage for an older lady living in Ohio whose fixed income was $2,400 a month, and she had enough equity in her house to end her mortgage forever. That relieved her of a $1,100 payment monthly, and to get $10,000 out. Her life is now so much better. So if you need a reverse mortgage, go to andrewandtodd.com. But the big news yesterday that will be absorbed today, the number of people seeking unemployment benefits continued to fall, according to the Wall Street Journal, meaning that they have plateaued as the U.S. labor market continues to mend. I think we have to be honest, it's a long road, said Jerome Powell on Wednesday. But in fact, that long road has begun to go up, up, up in terms of employment. And that's what matters the most. By the way, the election is going to turn on who do you think is going to guide the recovery better. Here's what Donald Trump has to say about the coming together of America. Cut number four.
In recent days, there's been vigorous discussion about how to ensure fairness, equality, and justice for all of our people. Unfortunately, there are some trying to stoke division and to push an extreme agenda, which we won't go for, that will produce only more poverty, more crime, more suffering. This includes radical efforts to defund, dismantle, and disband the police. They want to get rid of
the police. Stop for a second. You understand? He understands there's a choice between the radical left and a return to growth. And he laid it out last night, and I'm with Trump. Coming up, one of the greatest theologians of the age, Professor N.T. Wright, joined me for a conversation, which I'll play this hour and next in part, so you can glimpse a little bit of the bigger discussion that is always underway. History and Eschatology with N.T. Wright next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt on this Friday, June the 12th, 2020. It's an interesting Friday. I've given you my Washington Post column. Hour number three is the Hillsdale Dialogue today with Dr. Arn and Dr. Thomas West on Plato. And now in this segment and some of next hour, a conversation I had on Wednesday with perhaps the preeminent Protestant theologian of our era, Professor N.T. Wright of Oxford now, formerly Bishop Wright, author of 80 books known to hundreds of millions of people as perhaps the most penetrating New Testament scholar on the Protestant side of the river, one river, two banks. And he joined me for 50 minutes. I can't play all 50 minutes for you, but I can play for you segments of it. We did it by Skype so you can watch and listen if you're watching on YouTube or hughhewitt.com. I played part one yesterday. Here is part two of my conversation with N.T. Wright about his massive and wonderful new book, History and Eschatology, The Promise of Jesus and Natural Theology. I had to read it with Mr. Google, and I had Mike Regal to help me, and I will talk at length with Dr. Mark Roberts, our mutual friend, about it when I next see him. But I found it to be fascinating because my undergraduate work was in political theory from the Straussians, and my life has been spent in constitutional law. And I found that you were saying over my fields. I mean, you would go out of theology from these people named Bultmann and Schweitzer and Tillich and Barth, and you would wander into the Platonists, and you would duel with the Aristotelians. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. It's all coming together. But you were doing so from a perspective of Second Temple Jewish eschatology. Would you explain to the audience why that's different and how it is? Yeah. It's actually a challenge to everything I just named.
It really is. It really is, because the Jews were different, and Jesus was a Jew and Paul was a Jew, and they were thinking like Jews because the Jews were living in this great story, which was the story of God and the world, the story you get in their Bible, what we call the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures. And that story was an ongoing narrative. It's rather like the Roman Empire in Paul's day had a great story which people were telling about how it started off 700 or 800 years ago, and it was a republic for a long time, and then there was a big crisis, and now we have an emperor, and it's Caesar, and so life is now wonderful. And of course, nobody quite believed that, but that was the official narrative. But in the same way, the Jews had a much longer story, which was, we go back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, we've got Moses, we've got the Exodus, we've got King David, etc. But the world is a dark and difficult place, and the pagan nations have been beating up on us for the last 500 years, and our God has promised to do something about it. And how is that going to happen? What's it going to look like when he does? And within that, they had symbols, namely the temple, which they believed was the place where heaven and earth came together, and the Torah, the place where heaven and the instruction of humans comes together. And those guided who they were. Now, so often people in our day have said, oh, we can't go back to thinking like first century Jews because we are now modern Westerners. And one of the main things I'm trying to get across in this book is that the idea of us modern Westerners being different from the ancient world because we have modern science and technology is pure smokescreen, that what the Western world has been doing is living on a retrieval of the ancient philosophy called Epicureanism, which is, if there are gods, they're a long way away upstairs, we are down here, they don't bother us, and we don't bother them, to which most Christians have responded by saying, oh, we'll be Platonists, we have a soul which is going to heaven somehow. And I'm saying that is the wrong way of going about it, because we should get back and retrieve the Jewish perspective of Jesus, Paul and the rest, which is that God and his human creatures have come together in a totally new way, as always promised in the Old Testament. And now we should be living out of that, not translating it out into various forms of either ancient Greek or modern European philosophy. So long answer, but that's where it's all going.
You know, Professor Wright, at the end, when I make notes about a book like this, I try and summarize for myself what the impact was. And one of the conclusions I came away from, and I'll discuss a few more of them, is we are all on the road to Emmaus, but unlike, and you spend a lot of time about being on the road to Emmaus, but we're in the middle of a throng, and the throng is all headed in the same direction, and you're trying to get out of the, and that's modern Epicureanism. And the Enlightenment is all pushing us down this road away from the time of Jesus, away from Second Temple jewelry. And you're saying, get out of that road, turn around and go back. And it's very difficult to go against that throng. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that is completely fair. And it's why so often we get ourselves twisted up this way and that. Because one of the things that's happened, and this is, of course, very relevant to where we are right now, is that the Enlightenment has tried to get what should be the results of Christian belief without having the Christian belief underneath. For instance, it's tried to get social care or medical care, or particularly a polychrome, multicultural, globalized society, but without the gospel of Jesus at the heart of it. And the church should have been modeling the idea of a polychrome, multicultural society, all one in Christ Jesus, as Paul says in Galatians and Colossians. But we just haven't been doing that for the last 400 years. And so we have colluded with certain aspects of Western culture, which divides us up. And so when the Enlightenment then comes with its big agenda, says, you're all basically the same, so you should all get together, and won't that be nice? And then we worry because we have racism, or et cetera, so rampant. The answer is the church should have been modeling all along what it should have been like. And that's a Jewish vision, a vision of a differentiated unity, which you can hold on to from a Jewish and a Christian point of view, but it's very, very difficult to hold on to it from the modern secular point of view. So that's one of the reasons we are in right now.
Now, I want to assure everyone who's listening that at the center of the book that I'm holding up, History and Eschatology, are two declarations. On page 190, Professor Wright writes, the resurrection is impossible for an Epicurean, undesirable for a Platonist, unnecessary for a deist, meaningless for a pantheist, scary for an emperor. Professor Wright plants his flag on the resurrection and defends it. And on page 193, in what is a very winsome passage, you quote Karl Barth leaning over to a fellow theologian and remarking, quote, with considerable force, mark well, bodily resurrection. You add, Professor Wright, that was a fine moment in the history of modern theology. Why, Professor?
Because for so long, modern Western theology had just assumed that when people talked about the resurrection of Jesus, we all basically knew that it didn't happen and it hadn't happened, and that it was just a metaphor for something else, that Jesus' cause lives on, or that he is now the world's true Lord, or that our sins are now forgiven or something. But the idea that he was bodily raised from the dead, leaving an empty tomb behind him, right through the 19th century, most all Western, certainly Protestant theologians, just discounted that. And so to have Karl Barth, and this was at the end of his life in the 1960s, saying that he had come to the point of view where he realized it actually meant bodily resurrection, it meant what it said, and we had to reorder around it. That was a great moment, but the point is, why did it take him so long? And the answer was that even Barth, who was one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century, had been so steeped in that point of view that it took him a long time to work back to it. But ultimately, this is the Jewish perspective, that in the Jewish worldview, insofar as there is one thing we can call the Jewish worldview, there are two great things you have to say about God. One, he is the good and wise creator. Two, he is the God of justice who will put all things right. If you take away either of those, you don't need bodily resurrection. But if you've got both of them, then you have to say that God is planning to reaffirm the goodness of the created order. That, for me, is the hinge, as you rightly observe, upon which the argument of this book turns. That it's then in the created order itself, however mysterious, that we can see that God is doing a new thing. I mean, the title of this book is History and Eschatology, but the original title was Discerning the Dawn. I will show you the poster of the original lectures. There it is, Discerning the Dawn. Do you see?
Yes, I do. And in fact, it's in the YouTube video of the Gifford lecture that I watched. Introduced as Discerning the Dawn, and I wonder why you made that choice, or did your editor make it for you?
Well, it was a conversation, shall we say, between me and my editor, because he said, Tom, nobody will know what you mean by discerning the dawn. I kind of like that phrase, and I still use it a bit in the book. But part of the reason for History and Eschatology being the title is that one of my main conversation partners, as you mentioned, is Rudolf Bultmann. And Bultmann was the last New Testament scholar before me to do the Gifford lectures. That's way back in the 50s. That's like 60 years before me. It was another New Testament scholar doing it. So we decided to use his title, History and Eschatology, which is, of course, very much what the book is about, in order to say the conversation continues over that 60-year break, and maybe in another 60 years there'll be somebody else doing it. But let me talk about discerning the dawn, because the point is that with the resurrection of Jesus, and then with the work of the Spirit through the church in the world, what you ought to be able to see, if the church is doing its job, which it isn't always but does sometimes, is the signs of new creation. And the signs of new creation, when you think about them, retrospectively validate all the signs that you thought might be hints and signs of the presence of God within the old creation. So in chapter 7, I talk about the broken signposts, the things like love and justice and truth and freedom, which everybody, all humans, they know that these are good things, but they're strangely elusive. They let us down. Just when we think, here is the sign that there is a God, then love goes cold, or truth is denied, or freedom is squashed, or whatever it is. And so people then say, like Jean-Paul Sartre, life's just a sick joke, you can forget that. Instead, the resurrection says, no, these really were signals that signals of the presence of God. But in order to understand them, to read them aright, if you like, draw the right conclusions from them, you have to follow them through into the story of Jesus, because the story of Jesus going to the cross is precisely a story of justice denied, love trampled upon, truth spat upon, etc., etc. That it isn't that these are ladders up which we can climb to God. These are places where, in their very brokenness, God came down to us in the person of Jesus and in his crucifixion. So there you are. That's the very central argument of the book.
It is. I found fascinating the epistemology of love. And I want everyone in the audience to know, you're going to have to, like climbing a mountain, work harder on the first part, and then you pick up speed as you go down. And I found the second part a joy to read because I had done the work of the first part.
Yeah, exactly.
The oppression of modernity, I want to sum it up for you. You talk about defeating the defeaters and why it's important to know Second Temple theology in order to defeat the defeaters. I've hosted Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens on this show. Chris was actually a good friend of mine. Here is Richard Dawkins on the show summarizing what it is to go uphill in the face of the Epicurean split-level worldview. Would you play that clip for me, Dwayne?
Okay, do you believe Jesus turned water into wine?
Yes.
You seriously do?
Yes.
You actually think that Jesus got water and made all those molecules turn into wine?
Yes.
My God.
Yes.
Okay.
My God, actually, not yours.
And you know, Professor Wright, when I've had Mark Roberts debate Hitch, when I've had John Mark Reynolds debate Hitch, when I've had David Allen White debate Hitch, it's never hard for a theologian to win these arguments. It's awfully hard for a layman who tries. I mean, the oppression of the Enlightenment is everywhere.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But the trouble then is that many Christians, I think particularly in certain schools of American thought, many Christians think they have to answer the Enlightenment in its own terms, as it
yes.
were.
Now, we don't have to. We'll explain more next hour. But first, come back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Joined now by the poet laureate of the Hugh Hewitt Show, Tarzana Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Hugh. You know, I may be one of the few people of my generation who's never seen Gone with the Wind all the way through, and now perhaps I never will.
You won't?
While academics worked behind their ivory-covered walls, a squad to overthrow them was recruited down the halls. As they pursued their studies with enthusiastic rigor, the force for their demise was being trained with equal vigor. Teach your class, professor, but you'd better stay on topic or be sacked for your transgression, even if it's microscopic. They said within their precincts, let a thousand flowers bloom, but when the petals opened, they let locusts in the room. Whisper what you really think and watch out for the snitches. They'll put your life on trial like they did with Salem's witches. Tapping into wisdom, with which they've been endowed, they'll let you know what movies and opinions are allowed. The end of their endeavor should be noted for its lameness. The goal of their diversity is monolithic sameness. When I was young, the left mocked those with fundamental views. Don't you think it odd that now they're standing in those shoes? For those who fail to notice or this tyranny condemn, we lived with the conviction that there's more of us than them. But I can say from where I sit, just underneath this bus, unless we speak our minds, there'll soon be more of them than us. That's Repeat After Me by Tarzana Joe.
I will repeat that, Joe, and I'll make sure that people know where to find it, tarzanajoe.com. And it does speak to the spirit of the age. I wouldn't try and read it at People's Square in Seattle, though.
No. There goes my vacation to Pike Market. I was going to go buy a nice Bronzino and bring it home for cooking, but no.
Not a good idea. Now, tell me, Joe, are you open, like the rest of the country, for business?
Yes, I am. It's a great business because I do it in a little back room of my house. My social distancing is about 40 miles, so it's great.
If you need a poem for a retirement or a wedding, for an anniversary, or just for a friend who needs a pickup, TarzanaJoe@Reagan.com. Rates are reasonable versus absolutely extraordinary. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, you.
There you have Joe, and now you have ReliefFactor.com. When I was talking with N.T. Wright, the conversation recorded on Wednesday, we'll air more of it next hour. I forgot to tell you, don't forget your ReliefFactor.com. I'm not. I got a long drive today. And that means, by the end, it's 4 hours. Back to Kilmer. But I got my lukewarm coffee and I got my ReliefFactor.com, so I'm ready for the day. You ought to go and get yours, too. I hate not to do it when I normally do because it's the reminder for so many of you. But I make up for it now. It's only 7 minutes different. You can't blame me if you forgot your ReliefFactor.com. I told my daughter-in-law last week she's going to weed this weekend. Get her Relief Factor up to speed. I gave it to her. And I hope she's taken. I carry curcumin, resveratrol, and omega for anyone with lower back pain, anyone with cranky knees. If your knees make a sound every time you stand up, you need ReliefFactor.com.
I've only done 15 miles this week, and they're barking at me because it's been raining here in the Beltway. ReliefFactor.com. I want to go back to Donald Trump last night in Dallas before I go back to N.T. Wright next hour, because he said some important things. He talked about the need to counter racism and bigotry wherever it appears. Donald Trump, last night in Dallas, cut number two.
Every child should be able to grow up in a safe community, free from violence and fear. They've taken a lot of the police protection away in Chicago, and they have great, great police in Chicago. I know Chicago very well, but they're not allowed to do what they can do better than anybody. They could do the job very easily. Americans are good and virtuous people. We have to work together to confront bigotry and prejudice wherever they appear, but we'll make no progress and heal no wounds by falsely labeling tens of millions of decent Americans as racist or bigots. We have to get everybody together. We have to be in the same path, I think, Pastor. If we don't do that, we have problems, and we'll do that. We'll do it. I think we're going to do it very easily. It'll go quickly, and it'll go very easily.
But you know what? He probably did not know. The president probably did not know that on Wednesday in Paso Robles, California, a sheriff's deputy was ambushed and killed. And the man who ambushed him and killed him, the gunman, I'm not going to name him, eluded authorities for 24 hours and was caught yesterday after an extensive manhunt, and he was killed. I've just got to tell you that, and three other officers were injured. We forget every day what police and law enforcement face out there. And I want to thank every one of them who are listening right now. The president was thanking you tonight. I thank you, too. But there's still things we can do to promote safety, and the president said that. Cut number five.
So I'm going to be announcing four steps to build safety and opportunity and dignity. First, we're aggressively pursuing economic development in minority communities. We're doing it very powerfully. We've done it with opportunity zones, but we're going to go above that. At the heart of this effort is increasing access to capital for small businesses, and that's with minority owners in black communities. And we're going to get it done, and it should have been done a long time ago. It's been very difficult, very, very difficult for some people, been unfairly difficult. Second, we're confronting the health care disparities, including addressing chronic conditions and investing substantial sums in minority-serving medical institutions. We have medical institutions in some areas of our country that are a disgrace. I was going to say not up to standard. They're much worse than not up to standard.
He's so accurate. The president is so objective. Look, my Washington Post column on the differences between Trump and Biden is over at the landing page of the Washington Post right now. Go and read it. Send it everywhere. We have to reelect President Trump. I'm coming back with Professor N.T. Wright. Stay tuned.